So as we said last week, as we canter towards Christmas, we're taking some time each of these weeks to just stop and to pause and allow some of the songs of the season to remind us of some of the truths of what the Christmas story is really all about, that God has come to us, that God is with us. Last week, we looked at the song, O Holy Night, that in the words of that song, it reminds that there is the thrill of hope that a weary world can rejoice with. And it's found in the person of Jesus Christ. And this week we're going to look at possibly one of the most well-known, perhaps even the most favourite, dare I say it, of the carols, O Come All Ye Faithful. Anyone, is that anyone's favourite? It's not, is it? Okay. It's not one of the favourite ones at all. The carol apparently was originally written in Latin under the title Adestis Fideles. And it's believed to have been written by a guy called John Wade in around the 18th century. He was a hymnist, whatever that is. I didn't even know that job existed, but apparently you can have a job of being a hymnist. I don't think you write about blokes. I think it's about songs. The English translation was then done in 1841 by Frederick Oakley, and it's from that this well-known carol has now been sung for quite a few years now. So let's stop, let's remind ourselves, watch the video, remind ourselves of the truths encapsulated within this amazing carol.
Joyful and triumphant.
It's an amazing carol. It's an amazing carol. It's a song of invitation. It's a song of invitation. Oh, come, let us adore him. Oh, come, all ye faithful, joyful and triumphant. Oh, come, let us adore him, Christ the Lord. But as I stopped, as I thought and I reflected about it this week, has the invitation been delivered to the wrong address? Like, is it really for me? That first, oh, come all ye faithful, joyful and triumphant. When at times we can feel the opposite. I can feel doubtful, depressed and defeated. So therefore, does it mean it's not for me? Is the Christmas story just for those who ride on a crest of a wave, who never have any problems, who never have any challenges? Did Jesus just come for people such as those? For those who never have any problems in life, those who never have any doubts in life, who never have any worries in life. In which case, it's not for me. It might be for you, but I figured it then it wouldn't be for me. But the good news is that as we read through, as we listen to the truths of these words, what these words do and remind us of is that the one who has come is God himself, God incarnate. Like fully God, not a bit of God, completely God. And that as we come and we adore him, so we become faithful, joyful and triumphant from the inside out. Let's unpack this just a little bit more. See, the good news is that the Christmas story isn't just those who are faithful, joyful and triumphant. That Jesus calls, as he said himself, Matthew 11:28, he calls the weary and the burdened. He says, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. And he calls the sinners. Matthew 9:12-13. On hearing this, Jesus says it's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. He's talking to the religious leaders who are kind of going, who are you? He says, I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners. In other words, I've come for those who realize that they need somebody to come for them. Not those who think that they've got life sus, but those that realize that they haven't. And the very script of the Christmas story, as you read through it, you'll know it from years gone by, from nativity scene to nativity scene. Don't know quite how Daleks and all of those kind of things fit into it these days, but they seem to have kind of modernized it. But the very script of the Christmas story points us to the precious truth that it was never intended as an invitation for the perfect, those who had it sorted. The very wonder of a virgin birth and the arrival of God's Son, as marvelous as it might be, brought not wonder but stigma. It brought finger pointing. It brought name calling and it brought condemnation for a teenage girl who in the day would have been considered to be a harlot because of the reality that she was with child when she was not married and the child was not that of her fiancé. So much so that Joseph, Mary's fiancé, was so concerned by the public reaction that he planned to divorce, break off the engagement between him and Mary. Doesn't sit like a perfect scene. It's not one of family harmony and perfection. Then, having agreed to stick it out and work it out together, they then have to trudge 120 miles. We get this nice picture of Mary riding on the donkey, side saddle, you know, clothed in a blue gown and, you know, just swimmingly going along as Mary, Joseph, being the man, walked along. Almost certainly wasn't like that. You understand the culture and the context of the day, it was much more likely that Joseph would have been the one on the donkey and Mary would have been the one walking. She was 8 months pregnant in the heat of the day through the hills and the mountainous regions on the way to Bethlehem in the dangerous, risky, rocky areas that they would have had to walk. It's not like jumping in a taxi and whipping off to the hospital. It was far from perfect. You know? And then when they get there in Bethlehem, what do they discover? Everything's full. Because everyone's there. Should have gone on Trivago or lastminute.com before they went, perhaps. They discovered there wasn't any room. And instead of a nice, clean, sterile hospital or a palace for a king to be born in with midwives and at hand on every moment and every whimper and a beautiful fleece-lined Moses basket there ready to receive cute baby Jesus when he is born, the only place they can find to rest their head is an animal shelter, almost certainly something like a cave. Dirty, stinky, dusty. The manger full of straw. Not a nice, cozy fleece. There were no fanfares. There were no celebrations. There was no Skype calls home. There was no selfies. It was a far from perfect picture that God stepped from the splendor of heaven into the mess of this earth. There was no hashtags virgin birth. Retweet, tweet, favorite. And then, if that wasn't enough in itself, the first people to arrive to celebrate the birth was a bunch of shepherds, known as the lowlives of society, the cast-offs, dirty, smelly shepherds from a hillside. It's about as low as you could possibly be. Many of them as known scoundrels would have been in those days. Most of those would have been looked down on. And they're the first to arrive. And then, swiftly followed by a bunch of Middle Eastern stargazers. Mystics from the East. It's not like a picture of a holy birth, is it? That we see often on our postcards. It was far from faithful, joyful, and triumphant. Far from perfect. And right from the outset, it's almost as if the script has been written to make it abundantly clear for you and for me and for all humanity that he has come to and he has come for the least, the last, and the lost. He begins at a place which was pretty much as low as you could get to understand that anyone from the lowest that you can get up has access to the throne room of heaven. Perhaps the hymn should say, "O come all ye sinners, weary and burdened." But it kind of doesn't have the same feel. But the great news is that he doesn't leave us there. 2 Corinthians 5:17 reminds us, if anyone is in Christ, he is what? He is a new creation. The old has gone, the new has come. That we can become faithful, joyful, and triumphant. That actually the faithful, joyful, and triumphant is the invitation to who we can become and who he will make us as we embrace the truth and the wonder of what it is. In fact, it's not so much what we become, in other words, what we do, it's who we are in him. That as I embrace the gift that he offers me, not the gift that I offer to him, it is who I become. And I am becoming it more and more as I come and I adore him. The way to arrive, the carol reminds us very simply, the way that we become is to do just that, that we come and we adore. We adore Christ the Lord. As we focus our hearts and our attentions on him, and he becomes the focus of all that we do and all that we are, rather than the millions of other distractions around that would pull for our attention and for our energy, so we discover that we are becoming more faithful, more joyful, and more triumphant. Not I have to try to be that, but actually it is what he is making me, what he is developing in me, what is he creating me. And it starts as we understand the reality of the one who is in the manger. That he is the King of Kings. There is no one who is bigger, more powerful, has more authority than him. That he is the Lord of Lords. That he is the Alpha and the Omega. He is the beginning and the end. It says in the carol, he is begotten, not created. That he's the creator and the sustainer of the universe. He is the one who gives you breath to be able to sit here as you do right now. He's the one who at any moment could snap his fingers and bring the world to an end. And yet his grace and his mercy means that he doesn't. He is God's rescuer, the one who came to save us from our sin, that virus that separates us from the God of the universe, that virus that eats away and destroys us from the inside out. He's the one that came to rescue us from that. He is the author and the perfecter of our faith. In other words, the one who made it and the one who completes it. That little baby in the manger is a wonderful counselor. He is the mighty God. He is the Prince of Peace. He is the bread of life. He is the light of the world. He is the lifter of our heads and the transformer of our hearts. He is born King of Angels. So we are invited, therefore, because of who he is, to come and adore him. See, when we understand who the one is in the manger, it changes everything. We come and we adore him because he is Christ the Lord. That the one who is in the manger is not a helpful addition that can make our life better, though he can. The one in the manger is our peace, is our joy, is our hope. In fact, he is our only hope. Our only hope. So come and adore him. Wonder at him. Worship him. Give him the worship that is due to him because of all that he is. And as I come and I adore him, I focus on him, I think about him, I reflect about him, I center my life around him, so I find myself becoming more faithful, more joyful, and more triumphant. Not me doing it, but him doing it in me. How will we bow the knee? We humble ourselves in adoration before him. We come and we adore. And then I discover that I am becoming. Being transformed into the one who is faithful, joyful, and triumphant. It's, as I was reading in my devotions this week, a piece written by a guy called Richard Rohr, and he calls it the power of powerlessness. The power of powerlessness. You see, Bill Wilson and the other founders of the Alcoholics Anonymous movement rediscovered the spirituality of imperfection and powerlessness that actually we've lost, which actually was at the heart of that first Christmas story and was actually at the heart of the Christian story for the first 300 years. It just got lost somewhere around AD 300. Or at least it was relegated to a subtext once Christianity aligned with imperial thinking. Once we looked at society from the top instead of from the bottom, the church then began to focus its moral program on a path of ascent instead of descent, of aspiration instead of adoration. And when you align with the empire, when you align with the culture around you, you're forced to prefer a spirituality of achievement, of performance, of worthiness, of willpower. And then, of course, any of the talk about the fact that all people have sinned and fall short becomes incredibly unattractive. Now, there's no longer room for the last to be first, so that the first can be last. Conformity to cultural virtue then becomes much more important than the love of littleness itself, or the love of others who need our love. It's as if Christianity is saying, we have the perfect medicine for all that ails you. Grace and mercy. The only requirement for receiving it is to never need it. See, we put on the facade of religiosity sometimes, convinced that I must fake it so that I don't lose face with those in my community. I want to impress you, make you think that I'm doing great in my walk with Christ, when all that we were ever really asked to do and invited to do was to actually be authentic. And the very place of finding our true authentic selves is taking off the mask and stop being fake and admitting that actually I am broken, that I'm messed up, that I'm a sinner, that I need a saviour, that I can't do this without him. I can only do it with him. That's the place when life begins. That's the wonder of the gospel, when we embrace our brokenness, when we drop our facade, when I actually become authentically who I am. I'm just, the sadness is that even in the context of the church, that I'm afraid to do that because you might not like me very much. And so I continue to put on a facade. I continue to strive for what the cultural virtue has become rather than what we've been invited to become. And when we drop our facade, when we authentically become us, we then become open to the grace that is available to us. Jesus called himself a physician. He made his case clearly. Those who are well do not need a physician, but the sick do. I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners. And Bill Wilson and the Alcoholics Anonymous movement recognized this truth and understood that the only way to give everyone equal and universal access to the God is to base salvation or enlightenment on woundedness. On woundedness instead of self-created trophies. See, the place of empowerment and revelation in Alcoholics Anonymous is when I confess, my name is Steve Miles, and I'm an alcoholic. And in the community of which I'm a part, applaud me for being willing to admit my brokenness and my fallenness. Oh, that the church would be that. My name is Steve Miles, and I'm a sinner. Imagine that. And then the place, your small group, going, yes, woo, yes. And others going, my name is Phil Jones, and I'm definitely a sinner. What a perfect picture of grace and mercy that would be. Where we get alongside each other and go, come on. A writer called Julian of Norwich, apparently he's a woman, not a man, that threw me, says this: our wounds are our very trophies. They are the holes in the soul where the light and the life break through. So as Leonard Cohen in his song Anthem puts it, forget your perfect offering, there is a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in. He goes on to say, as he writes about this song, he says that is where the light gets in, or where the crack is, and where the light gets in. He says, that is where the resurrection is. That's where the return is, and that's where repentance is. And the way of the 12 steps of the Alcoholics Anonymous is incredibly similar to the steps of the gospel, the way of the cross. It's the power of powerlessness. until you bottom out and come to the limits of your own fuel supply, there is no reason for you to switch to a higher octane fuel. Why would you? You won't learn to draw on a larger source until your usual resources are depleted and used up. In fact, we can almost forget that there's a larger source sometimes, because I'm just getting on my life in my own strength. And it's only when my resources utterly fail me often that I then look out to one to be the source to what I need him to be. If indeed any of us ever end up going to the place of powerlessness on our own accord, we have to be taken there, sadly, often. Sin, humiliation, failure, various forms of addiction. They're the kind of things that bring us to that point. Perhaps sometimes we've ruined our marriage, or we've ruined our children or our job or our sterling self-image, and we have to reach that point where we say, my way isn't working. Maybe there's another way. Maybe I really do need to change. It's often at that point where we're finally ready to begin a sincere spiritual journey, where we reach the point where we're ready to come and adore him. And at that point, our religion morphs into a living spirituality. It becomes the doorway which leads us to become joyful, faithful, and triumphant. Here is the wonder of the gospel. Here is the wonder of the Christmas story. The more I come and adore, the more faithful, the more joyful, and the more triumphant I discover that he is making me.